You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com. We thought you might like to know that there is an organization in Indianapolis that focuses on teen homelessness. Their name is Outreach Indiana, and you can learn more about them at OutreachIndiana.org. And today, I have the privilege of speaking to their Chief Executive Officer, Andrew Neal. We talk about how pervasive in Marion County homelessness is. How can they reach more, and how can you help reach more homeless teens? And how does Indianapolis deal with homelessness in a way that other cities might not? Is that good or bad? We find out more here on The Chris Spangle Show. Stephanie Solomon, Youth Programs Coordinator, thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
So tell me a little bit about what you do at the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence.
Sure. Yeah. So I am the Youth Programs Coordinator, and I'm part of the prevention team at the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We are the state coalition for domestic violence programs. I see us kind of as an umbrella for the domestic violence work that's being done across the state. We have a really holistic approach from connecting survivors to whatever needs they have, whether that be housing, economic needs, legal needs, but also focusing on prevention. So doing what we need to do until violence ends. And our strategies are really all based around supporting communities across Indiana in doing what they need to do to be safe, stable, and nurturing.
So I think the listener's mind might jump directly to maybe your organization is a women's shelter and you do direct intervention, but it's a little more complex. It's a very complex issue. I've had several friends in my life that have gone through this, and there is an entire parastructure, not just in intervention, but you said you work in prevention. Can you talk about the two differences? Like, what's the difference between the prevention side and the intervention side? And is there other sides that I'm missing here?
I mean, I think there's always multiple sides to any social issue that we talk about. But when I think about the work of ICADV, we're doing both intervention and prevention. And so the intervention side is you're in a violent situation and you need legal representation or you need another place to stay. So either a domestic violence shelter or supported housing of some kind. And so we're not the place that you come to stay. We're not going to be the organization that puts a roof over your head and has meals. We're the organization that's going to help you find whatever those resources are that you need. So that's kind of the intervention side of what we do. So survivors across Indiana, they hit crisis and we intervene. In that really what I see as holistic way. Prevention is more saying that it doesn't have to be this way. We do not have to see domestic violence as a given or as a norm. And with the rates being what they are, we often assume this is just the way it is. And so we have to intervene because there's no other choice. Prevention is about what kind of conditions would allow for a world where we weren't needing to intervene in a regular way when it came to domestic violence, where we really could support and promote health and well-being and safety for our communities.
I don't want to be indelicate here. I think when domestic violence is often talked about, it's sort of on the women and supporting women, right? Is there an emphasis in what you do on the prevention side that is more on the male side? And I'm not saying that all domestic violence, there are certainly men who go through domestic violence. I know we saw some debate around that with the Johnny Depp trial. There's certainly abuse that happens towards men. But I mean, the numbers are largely on the male side. Is a little bit of your work trying to find strategies to help choose a different path than maybe leaping towards anger?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's because I focus on prevention with youth. When it comes to perpetrators of violence and gender, I mean, what I've seen as a person who's been doing prevention and social service work for a long time, is that a norm and an idea about domestic violence is that the perpetrators are men, and the survivors, victims and then survivors, are women. But it's actually, in many ways, from a prevention perspective, a lot of those gender norms are what support violence in the first place. And so it's messier than that. The idea that, there are neat categories of who is a perpetrator and who's a survivor. And that has been a really, interesting thing to learn about, as I've entered this world.
What are some things that you've seen that make you say that? Give us let us see through your eyes a little bit.
Well, I mean, I guess the best example is that when I was in college in 2000 to 2004, the women's shelter in my community was a women's shelter. So regardless of the domestic violence that was taking place in your household, you had to be a woman in order to access shelter. And joining with ICADV and kind of watching, as a person who's worked in social services for a long time and in nonprofits, we've seen that, perpetrators can be different genders. It doesn't follow this cultural story as closely as I mean, we want cultural stories to make sense of things, and right, sometimes they miss really important details. And so a lot of shelters now are naming the fact that they aren't women's shelters. They're shelters for people who experience violence.
I love that, because I've had situations in my friend circle where the man has been the victim of domestic violence, and that I found out was a miracle. Opening up and saying that this was happening to me is just wrapped around so much shame for men, and it's very difficult, and you don't know where to turn. And so that's really interesting to hear that need is kind of being seen and met.
Yeah, I think it's one of the directions that we're going as a culture that is really challenging but really necessary, is really interrogating our assumptions about gender in general, but also the way that it shows up. So that stigma, the shame, that's affecting all kinds of outcomes when it comes to domestic violence. Even just the idea that if you have disclosed that you experienced violence and then you stay with a partner, and there's lots of reasons why people do, often reaching out for resources feels inaccessible because folks are so ashamed. And so that stigma and that shame, that's another one of those cultural norms that's affecting everyone, and affecting men in this particular way because of what our beliefs are about how men should move in the world.
So you work primarily with youth, and I have to say I have become a much more open-minded person, a much more less narrow-minded, less, you know, I grew up on Married with Children. That was like my formative show. Like, so when you look back and like watch that show, you're like, wow, that's why I had all these screwed up notions of masculinity and femininity and all this stuff, kind of what you're talking about. What are some other, when you're talking with young people about cultural influences, and, you know, I love the mission of your organization, which is an end to violence, just period, mm-hmm. not just domestic violence, but violence, yep. which I can certainly sign on to. It's been a huge part of my broadcasting career is just talking about why are we turning to violent means? What are some ways that you're trying to help teens see a different path and see a different future that endorses nonviolence?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I'm going to bring up the tension of the fact that we are seeing an increase in violence within schools and for young people in general. I was kind of shocked to learn that in Indiana, 1 in 10 high school age teens have reported experiencing some form of physical violence from a dating partner in the last year. And so I want to name that before really going into, you know, how we can talk about violence prevention, with young people is that they're coming in a cultural context that I think is a little different than when I was a young person navigating these issues, So we often talk about what are the gender norms that you're seeing around you, what resonates with you in your experience, and what doesn't. And I find that that's a really helpful way to engage young people in those conversations, because often, I mean, lots of young boys are sensitive, and girls are, assertive. And so some of these, binaries that we've created, we see it as adults. But imagine if we had been talking about that directly when we were young people.
I'm not going to ask you your age. That would be impolite of me. I'm 38, and growing up in the late 90s,
Proud of my age. I am fine to tell you that I just turned 40.
Congratulations.
It brings wisdom with it.
Yes. And you and I kind of went to school around the same time. And I think when you said gender norms, so of course that triggers half the audience. But I think what I'm hearing you say is just making space for emotions and like not stereotyping people. Like one of the best things that ever happened to me was reading Brené Brown and going, oh, I'm allowed to like accept that I'm a sensitive person, like, and kind of get away from some of that stuff. Is that just such a necessary part? A, am I right in assessing what you're saying? And then B, is how important is that in reducing domestic violence among school age people?
I mean, yeah, I think your assessment is right on. there's an association between this feeling that I shouldn't show my emotions and then venting or kind of exploding and having violence end up being the way that emotions bubble up over time. I mean, we're all human. And so we're gonna let that energy out. Conflict is part of life. And I think that, I lost my train.
No, you're good. I think it's exactly right. I think, so tell me about how you, like, is there exercises? Do you go into schools? Do you facilitate groups? Like, how do you actually facilitate these conversations with students?
Yeah, so there's a lot of preventionists across the state that do go into schools and work directly with kids around healthy relationships. But really, with our youth council, the idea is that we're looking more at systems than we are at interpersonal or like one-on-one relationships. Because that's happening already. A lot of our communities and a lot of our member agencies are going into schools and having conversations with kids about things like consent and healthy relationships. But when I'm working with young people on our youth council, we're more talking about what are these bigger systems that are influencing what's happening to you at school. So there are those stories about, the relationships that are happening and friendships and all of those interpersonal things that make up our lives. But we're taking it a step further and we're saying, okay, what's influencing that? And how can we address those wider influences? One of my favorite stories that one of my colleagues tells is about a high school where in the hallway, there was this one spot where fights were regularly breaking out. And the administration was like, Is there some solution to what we can do? How do we talk to the kids about not fighting with each other? But it didn't end up being talking to kids that changed things. It was changing the route from class to class in the high school so that there wasn't this buildup of kids all in the same hallway trying to go opposite directions at the same time. So in some ways, prevention work is about zooming out. And offering the opportunity for young people to zoom out in a way that maybe as adults we can't because we're not walking we're not walking the same hallways that they are every day.
Yeah, I think the older I get, the more tasks I have, the more tasks I need to check off and the less I listen, which is especially a very middle-aged male thing to do. But part of your job is also just kind of giving teens more of a voice. So how do you try to give teens more of a voice and what have you learned from them?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. I think, when I think about just the way that we orient towards young people, we want so badly to create safety for them. And then sometimes the things that we're doing, those tasks that you're talking about, can lead us to kind of, not notice what they're trying to tell us. And so I see the center of my work being listening deeply to young people. And then also hearing from them, not just hearing their voices, but hearing the strategies and ideas that they have about what could improve the conditions in their own lives. And what I'm hearing from kids is that they want connections. And I'm sure some of this is about, the ways that the pandemic impacted school for kids. And some of those big policies led to isolation. And my favorite thing that I'm hearing from kids is how much they appreciate connecting with each other, first of all, but also with the caring adults in their lives. And we know that from studies done by the CDC around violence prevention, that having caring adults and mentors in the lives of young people who listen to them and support them can really change the trajectory of young people's lives. So, and I love that it feels like an honor that I get to hear the stories of young people, especially as a 40-year-old. And some of it I connect with because I was a teenager at one point. And some of it is so new. There was, as you know, there was no TikTok. There was no, the internet was just like a twinkle.
It was the golden age. You had GeoCities and you could go, and then Facebook ruined it all. And then these kids these days, Stephanie Solomon of the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence, are just on their phones all day. You're telling me that they actually want to connect and to connect with people their parents' age? How How can that be true? And there are a lot of adult ears listening who have a lot of influence over, you know, maybe teenage kids. Like, what can adults do better to aid some of that?
Chris, I want to flip that on its head, because those adults these days can't get off their phones.
You're a social worker. I've got friends in the social worker world at elementary schools saying kids are they're going through neglect because their parents are on their phone too much.
Yeah. So I'm in public health, so I won't claim to be any kind of counselor or therapist, but on a population level, I think one of the things that adults can do is pay attention to what's the environment when I'm around young people. So whether that's a teacher, an administrator, a parent, an aunt, an uncle, how attentive am I being to the young people that are around me, and how available am I? I'm not blaming any of us on the individual level. We have a world where we have emails and texts, and, you know, often the work-life boundaries have it so that there are people communicating with us all the time, and there's a sense of urgency. And so what would it look like as a culture if we said, if we put the urgency of our emails ahead of the urgency of being present with our young people, what could the world look like? That's a norm that I think we as adults need to be attentive to, is how can we also pay attention to things other than our phone?
You know, it's not to drag current events into it, but we've just seen so many times and so many of these instances of violence with young people. There were a lot of signs there, you know, and imagine if more parents, coaches, teachers, I guess that's one question that I have that maybe you can answer, that I always kind of see with some of these situations. I go, is there just not a network? Like, are the teachers not talking to each other or talking with local law enforcement? Or, you know, I don't want to delve into specific acts like gun violence in schools, but do you just sort of see those gaps where the adults in some of these kids in crisis lives are not communicating, or they're not intervening with, clearly a young person is being violent, or they see signs of somebody being abused and they're not willing to step in? And how can we, is that something that we can change, or are you working on?
I definitely believe it's something we can change. And I think every question you've asked, I've brought it back to a norm.
Yeah.
Or some kind of cultural narrative. But we tend to silo ourselves. So if you're in law enforcement, you're in social services, you're in education, we're not great at communicating across those sectors. And so I think the promise is us really working on, there's the assumption, it's not an assumption, it's a reality that we are all connected. Somebody needs to pick the food that I eat in order to have safety. There's all these different institutions that I need to have access to. And so if we took that really seriously, how interconnected we all are, and we started breaking down those silos of communication and collaborating together, I think there's incredible promise in that. And I know that those are just words, but I think that there are examples and models that we can practice with of how we can be working across our silos more effectively.
I don't know that they're just words. Like, Indianapolis is a great city because it's got something special. It has a very strong civil sector to it, and it always has been. It's why we have so many monuments in downtown Indianapolis, because there were so many groups networked together. And I think it's as the population has grown, those relationships kind of fray and people, like you say, get siloed. But there is like a spirit around education, for instance, in Indianapolis, where there is a lot of cross communication. And I think with the rise in violence, maybe there's just some, again, to use the words, intentionality that all these different groups can kind of talk together. So we're talking a little public policy and how that influences domestic violences and the conditions. You know, what's another big social norm that you see that kind of is a current that can lead somebody towards either being a victim or a perpetrator of domestic violence? What's one thing that really concerns you that we haven't talked about?
I mean, I think we talked about stigma, and a lot of that stigma comes from this idea of privacy, and that I see as coming from individualism, that we're all kind of, you know, our own little, there's a good saying for that, but of course, at the time I need it, I can't. We're all islands. So we have this feeling of like, if there's a problem, it's not necessarily socially appropriate to ask for help. And maybe, in fact, it's seen as weak to ask for help. And I think that that is another narrative that we that could be transformational for us to start connecting with our neighbors, with our communities in a way that breaks that individualism, and where we can see the strength in asking for help. I mean, it's incredible what resources and supports we can offer each other when we're listening deeply and communicating clearly and authentically with one another. So I think that's one where, you know, I understand the drive for self-sufficiency and kind of the roots in our culture for that. But I think that you brought up Brené Brown. Connection is really powerful. So when we talk about violence prevention, that connection piece, that breaking of isolation, creation of belonging and inclusion, I think can go a long way to breaking some of those cycles of violence that we see, whether it's in, you know, a couple or on a wider scale.
Yeah, there's just no doubt that we have to be connected to each other, and we're all in this together. Isolation, as we've seen the last 3 years, just doesn't really work well for human beings. They like to be around people. All right, end with shameless self. Well, let me ask you the question before the second to last thing. What do you see on a daily basis that you wish everybody understood about your work?
Oh my gosh. I think that what I see on a daily basis is the power of a group of people coming together and really interrogating and looking at an issue and saying, how can we collaborate and what systems can we impact to make a better world? And that a lot of that starts with relationships, not just relationships, you know, with, you know, one-on-one interpersonal relationships, but relationships with the organizations and institutions that surround us. I'm talking about schools and libraries and community organizations working together. So that's where I find my hope and my promise. And I think ICADV does that exceptionally well, especially on a state level. So we're talking really a broad group of humans and institutions, and the kind of collaboration that it takes to change the world.
you and I couldn't be more like-minded on so much of this. I mean, it's what I've been... That's the reason the show exists, is just to network people together and try to get people involved and to get them engaged in their community again. And if they want to do that, shameless self-promotion time, you know, how can people help your organization time-wise, monetarily? How can they help you specifically as the youth programs coordinator at the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence?
Well, if you go to our website, icadvinc.org, which I see is along the bottom of the screen, that's one way. You can also find us on Facebook and other social media platforms. I think Facebook is the most active. But there are opportunities to partner with us as a funder, to partner as a volunteer, to partner with all the different things we do, from the crisis work to legal to prevention. Specifically, teenagers across Indiana, or parents or guardians of teenagers, have the opportunity to connect directly with our youth council through me. And you can find that from the website, or just directly contact me at ssolomon, and that's S-S-O-L-O-M-O-N, at icadvinc.org. And I would be thrilled to have more young people from a wider swath of the state getting engaged in violence prevention and the bigger work of making this a better world for all of us.
Stephanie Solomon of the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence Youth Programs Coordinator, thank you so much for being with me. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Chris.